Torture in Abu Ghraib prison, corporate fraud, falsified records at Veterans Administration hospitals, teachers pressured to feed test answers to students. These scandals could have been prevented if, early on, people had said no to their higher-ups. In his new book, Intelligent Disobedience, Doing Right When What You're Told to Do Is Wrong, Ira Chalif goes deeply into when and how to disobey inappropriate orders, reduce unacceptable risk, and find better ways to achieve legitimate goals. Ira Chalif is the founder and president of Executive Coaching and Consulting Associates. He's been named one of the 100 best minds on leadership by Leadership Excellence magazine. Again, the new book is Intelligent Disobedience, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Ira Chalif to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be here, Joe.
What led you to this topic of ultimately looking at intelligent disobedience?
A lot of my work has been around the subject of leading and following, and how when you're not the leader, how do you make sure the leader is successful? How do you help him or her be successful? But if they're doing something that's not right, how do you diplomatically but candidly give them that feedback for the good of what they're trying to do? As part of this, I do a lot of training with mid-level senior managers. And one day, a woman in the class said, you know, I have an example of what you're talking about under the table. And I said, what do you mean under the table? And she said, well, I'm training a guide dog. It's going to be a dog that works with a blind person. And after it learns to obey everything that it needs to know, all the commands it needs to know, it then must learn how not to obey if obeying a command would produce harm. And in guide dog training, that's called intelligent disobedience. And I realized that that's a perfect metaphor for what we're trying to do with human beings as well. How do we help people differentiate between when they should obey? Most of the time that's fine. And when they shouldn't, where doing so would produce a wrong result.
And what is it about that training of guide dogs that is it is it easier to train them than it is to train us?
What a great question, because I'm not sure we've done enough with us to know the answer to that.
Right.
But what happens with guide dogs is that it's a very precise art, because you don't want the dog to become confused. Should I obey? Shouldn't I obey? It really has to understand sort of the rules of the game, how to keep the person safe, and how and when to resist an order. And they have very clear ways of training the dog in that. Now, obviously, we're talking about human beings. We're not talking about training dogs. It's more complex with human beings. But the basic principles apply, which is that we need to give people some practice in when and how not to obey. And in some of our really critical industries like aviation or hospital surgery rooms, we're beginning to do a good job of that. But we need to extend it more broadly into our culture.
I'm curious, because you asked the question in the book of why perfectly rational adults so often obey irrational rules and commands. And I'm curious as to the answer of that to that. But I'm also curious as to why, because I think it obviously plays into it, of why we also, these same rational adults, so often disobey rational rules and commands.
Yeah. Well, every culture needs to instill in its young an understanding of the rules of the culture and how to get along. And if we fail to do that, you know, we know that our child gets kicked out of kindergarten or whatever it is. So learning the rules is really important. But we seem to do that a little too well, and we don't create the balance. And there's a lot of disturbing social science research that shows that even if somebody doesn't have true authority, they just look like they have authority, that too many of us will obey when we should really stop and think, does that make sense? Should I do that? Is that the right thing to do? Now, there is so much. There's this, particularly in, let's say, in adolescence, etc., there's a certain acting out against authority. So we give that a lot of attention. But in fact, historically, worse things are done when people obey orders that they shouldn't than when they act out a bit in defiance of authority. So we really have to pay more attention to how do we strike the right balance.
You write in the book about the difference between intelligent disobedience and civil disobedience. You distinguish between the two. How so?
Civil disobedience has a very honorable history in our culture. We know that in the civil rights movement and even earlier. But civil disobedience is basically saying there is an injustice embedded in the rules and laws of society as it exists. And the individual who decides that this really needs to change makes a conscious decision to publicly violate those laws, to bring attention to the injustice. They're willing to accept the consequences, and their aim is to get those laws changed. Intelligent disobedience is a narrower subject. It's usually saying the laws are reasonably fair, the authority is reasonably competent, but what I'm being asked to do in this particular situation is not right. It is a misuse of that authority or poor judgment, and I need to hold myself accountable for whether I obey or don't obey. That's intelligent disobedience. It's the opposite of the defense, which is no defense at all, of saying, well, I was just following orders, if you then wind up doing something harmful by following that order.
What if you're concerned of the ultimate punishment, which would be getting fired?
Well, that's a risk, but there are greater risks than being fired, even though it sometimes doesn't seem like that. So, for example, in the book, I talk about what happened at WorldCom, where the mid-level accountants were pressured to manipulate the quarterly numbers to make the company look better and keep the stock price up. And initially they resisted, but then they caved, they went along, and after a few months it became clear that what was being done was illegal. And those mid-level managers, accountants, went to jail. So Is it worse risking losing your job or going to jail? And oftentimes what will happen, even though it seems like your job could be at stake, if you say to the person giving you the order, here's why this isn't a good idea, and here's why I can't do this, if you really feel that this is the right thing to do, you're going to need to do it yourself. That often is enough to get them to step back, reflect, and take a safer and more ethical course of action.
In that ethical course of action, does intelligent disobedience become, in some cases, whistleblowing?
It can, but whistleblowers pay a very dear price. So the whole effort here is not to necessarily encourage whistleblowing. It's to create a culture within an organization that hopefully will lead to self-correction. And what I'm trying to do here in this book is do that both in our professional settings, but also dial it back to how do we build the character at a very early age where people know how to take the stance that's right for that situation. And what I'm hoping happens with this book is that parent reading groups and K through 12 teachers take a look at what can we do better in the classroom, in the family, before, in preschool, in scouts, etc., to build that character capacity.
So put it into some sort of historical context. Have we gotten worse at this? Have we developed into people who are doing the wrong thing, or is this something that has always been with us?
I think it's something that has plagued humanity in virtually every culture. So it's not that we are doing the wrong thing, but there is a problem that we as Americans like to think of ourselves as highly independent, frontier mentality, and, you know, we will do the right thing. Unfortunately, both the research and the history shows that under certain circumstances, most of us will not stand up early enough to what we're being asked to do that's wrong. So I think to bring our national image, our self-image, and our behavior more into line, we need to work at this. And it's particularly becomes more problematic in an age where authority knows everything about us and can put quite a bit of pressure on people. We still need to understand how do we do the right thing even when under pressure.
Ira Chalif is the author of the new book, Intelligent Disobedience, Doing Right When What You're Told to Do is Wrong. Let me ask you about Susan Bowles, an elementary school teacher in Gainesville, Florida. Tell us a little bit about her story.
Yeah, this is a hot-button issue right now, Joe. It has to do with standardized testing. Susan Bowles was a second-grade teacher, and she found that her second-grade students, she was being ordered to give too many tests. She wasn't against testing, but there was so much testing that it was interfering with what she considered her professional responsibility to appropriately instill her second graders with a love for learning and a capacity for learning. And she took a very bold stand where she sent out a social media message to the parents in her class and said that she had decided that one of the tests that was particularly onerous, she had decided she was not going to administer it. And she understood that her job could be on the line, and she wanted them to know that if she suddenly wasn't there, what had happened. Well, the community rose up in support of her, and this is a story that has a happy ending, where the state of Florida changed its testing requirement for that specific test for second graders. In contrast to that, we have the headlines that were made recently about the teachers in Atlanta who were under such pressure to make sure that the test scores looked good that they fudged the results, and something like 9 of them received jail sentences for falsifying the test results. So again, there's an example of it's not always safe to obey, even though it seems that your job is at stake if you didn't obey.
We touched on this, but I want to go into a little more detail because you write a lot about Stanley Milgram's famous experiment. Talk to us a little bit about his work on obedience and how you wanted to focus in ultimately to make your point.
Yeah, so for those listeners who may not have a frame of reference, these were experiments that Dr. Milgram did at Yale University in the 1960s, and there was a simulated electric shock that the subject was supposed to give to learners to see if it would help them learn better. They weren't really getting shocks, but the subject didn't know that, and two-thirds of the subject kept administering the shocks even when they thought that the person was under severe stress and maybe even threat of damage or death. And these are very disturbing findings. What we have forgotten about is that Stanley Milgram did a variety of experiments to see how could we reduce the number of people that would obey when they knew they shouldn't be obeying. And he came up with certain ways of organizing social behavior to improve our response to authority that was misusing its power. In the book, I go into that's what I'm interested in. How do we do this right? How do we help people to do this right? And I hope that I've done a good job in reviving some of Stanley Milgram's work in that direction.
There's a disturbing nature to his findings, but you say there are elements that are very important, ultimately hopeful. And some of this having to do with ultimately what's leading to many of our anti-bullying programs that we've put in place now.
Yes, we have a couple of programs in our K-12 school system, which are starting to touch on the capacity for intelligent disobedience. One of them is the anti-bullying program, where we have come to understand that there are always three parties involved in bullying: the perpetrator or bully, the victim, and the bystander. And ultimately, it's the bystander that has the most potential to change the situation. If two or three bystanders will speak up against the bullying drops dramatically. And so schools are beginning to introduce that concept of you cannot stand by silently when you see something being done wrong. Similarly, in child safety against sexual predators, there are programs that are being introduced to help very young children understand how to say, no, I don't want to be touched that way. It's unfortunate that these are the areas that we have to introduce these skills, but they are a platform on which we can build the skills into more generalizable skills of good citizenship, of good corporate citizenship, and of good citizenship as United States in a democracy, where we don't want to respond to authoritarian rules, but to a more egalitarian democratic process.
I thought this was a fascinating aspect of the book. What is our responsibility as a bystander?
Well, our responsibility is, if we can, to take a stance against the bullying. And when I say if we can, it is true that the first bystander who takes a stance, the bully will redirect his or her venom, if you will, towards that bystander. So it takes courage. And this is where the second or third bystander becomes so important, because if they will come to the support of the first bystander who stands up to the bully, that's when the bullying drops. And this isn't just a schoolyard situation. This happens in the workplace. It happens in the military. And on a very large canvas, it's what happens at the national level when minorities get targeted if the majority stands by silently. So we all have that responsibility at a fundamental level.
I'm curious, let us bring in the name of Edward Snowden. So he goes up against the NSA, ultimately against the U.S. government. He's doing what he thinks is right. This gets back, I guess, in some way to the whistleblowing question. Is he a good representation of intelligent disobedience?
Edward Snowden is more an example of civil disobedience. He's not a classic example, but he is an example in the sense that he knew the rules, he knew the laws, and he made a decision to violate them and to publicly violate them to bring attention so that they could be reviewed, and if the American people and the government agreed, they would be changed. Now, he's not a classic example of civil disobedience because he fled the country and didn't, stand trial. And there may be some good reasons for why he chose to do that. But nevertheless, that puts a certain question mark over his actions. Again, I'll use that, though, to distinguish between intelligent disobedience. It may have been the only way that we to bring awareness of this. And of course, we do have the Congress is now, and the White House have changed the laws. So it wasn't that he was wrong. The question is the way he did it. History will have to be the judge of that. But it's not the poster child necessarily for intelligent disobedience.
In that idea of history will have to be the judge of this, let me ask you about your optimism of us changing as a culture and as a society and becoming more intelligently disobedient.
I believe that it will take a generation or two to actually do this work. I believe it starts in the home, where instead of telling the child, you do it because I told you to do it, that we help to bring up an understanding of why we as the authority figure are asking them to do something or telling them to do something and helping them to understand under what circumstances they should obey and what circumstances they are entitled to question or even disobey. This is a very fundamental piece of childhood development. I think we then need to, as parents and parent groups, bring this kind of differentiation into other socializing forums, such as early childhood education, scouting, religious education, etc. If we understand that by doing this, we will in fact ensure a 21st century citizenry that it remains free and true to the American ideal, I think we can change that behavior. And frankly, it would be one of the greatest things that humanity has done, because we all know with a certain amount of horror when we look back at World War II and the people who said they were just following orders and exterminating millions of people. We know that that is not good enough, and it's our obligation to really work to change that in our culture.
Ira Chaloff's new book is Intelligent Disobedience, Doing Right When What You're Told to Do is Wrong. The book is published by Barrett Kohler. Ira Chaloff, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Very nice to have you and share your thoughts with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Joe.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Intelligent Disobedience. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.